Interview with John Pinto, March 12th, 2010, in Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Durr.
Well, a little bit of background. You went to Rutgers, is that right? Was that law school?
No. Rutgers was... Rutgers in Newark is where I ultimately graduated from.
Okay.
I went to high school in Newark, New Jersey, Essex Catholic High School. And then from there I went to, and I graduated in 1961, from there I went to Newark College of Engineering. After a period of a couple of years, realized clearly that engineering was not what I wanted to do or could do, and
yeah.
It's probably thankful for people driving over bridges that I wasn't involved in engineering. So I left there after a couple of years, and then my first real job was with Household Finance, mainly in Newark, although I worked in a number of their offices, and I was there about 4 years.
What were you doing?
Well, you go in as making loans, collections, and I had gone through the qualification program that they had to be a manager, and I was qualified as a manager, and I managed a couple of their offices in Orange and Newark and what have you for a period of time as a fill-in for the manager. But so I left there. But there I was involved in retail credit.
Right.
And it was during I was in the Newark office during the riots in Newark, so it was interesting getting back to work during that time with a gentleman sitting on the desk at the door with a shotgun. But anyway, I left there and went to work for Worthington Pump in Harrison, New Jersey. And there it was in the industrial credit area. And that was mainly, if not exclusively, on the collection side. And I wasn't there for very long. I think I went there sometime in 1968 and left there probably very beginning of 69, and on January 27th of 1969 I joined the NESD.
Okay. Was Richard Wilbert the president at that point?
Dick Wilbert was the, back then I was still walking around looking at the big skyscrapers, but I think Wahlberg was the president.
Gordon Macklin wasn't.
Gordon came on after I was here.
Okay.
So Dick Wahlberg was the head of the NESD back at that time.
What was your title when you came in?
I worked at that point. I joined the district. At that time, it was District 12, which is the New York District office, and I started there as an examiner trainee. The director there was George Bergen. Was another name, by the way, who's got history that really would get you back to where you'd want to go. I've got depending what you whether you want to do this now or later, but there's a couple of names of guys that are around that were really like pioneers back when they were really kind of almost getting started.
Yeah.
And George is one of them. But George was the director and ultimately became vice president. But that's who ran the New York office. And I started as an examiner trainee, which was an entry-level position for the examining ranks.
Yeah.
And I was there a week, and then we went down for a training class down here in D.C. Actually, part of the training was in this building. The NESD executive office used to be at 888 17th Street before Gordon bought the other building on K Street.
Tell me about your first big assignment when going in and examining.
Well, the big assignment for me was, once you get to, go through the training process, you go out with folks and, you kind of get a flavor for it. I did a number of examinations, as I recall, on my own in the South Jersey area down the Jersey Shore. We had a number of firms. Well, let me step back. The first big stuff, the period of time I joined was 69, so it was right after what was then... the 68 period where the market, the volume picked up and what have you. And the first big major thing that I recall us doing were control examinations. meaning we would go in because of the issue, the concern that, one, because of the, at that point, sharp increase in daily volume. If you remember back then, I think they even closed on Wednesday to try to get everything up to date. But the sharp increase in volume, plus the fact that you had firms, because the NESD's membership is very broad. It covers, you know, little mom-and-pop shops, and it covers Merrill Lynch. So you've got a wide range of different kinds of businesses that fall under the mantra of over-the-counter. And NESD regulates all of the over-the-counter markets, mutual funds, and what have you. And because of the activity, many firms would either start up doing securities business, where before maybe they were doing just mutual funds or other kinds of products that weren't the sale of securities, or their business increased in volume. And there was a concern about the ability for them to maintain accurate books and records and to keep that information up to date. So we would go in and do control examinations, meaning you'd go in and look at the stock record as far as what information they say they have. And stock record tells you who owns it and where it is. I mean, there's a number of categories in both of those, but who owns it and where it is. And then you would go back to the subsidiary record. So if it said on the stock record, for example, they're long 3,000 shares in the trading account, you'd go back to the subsidiary record and find that they're long 9,000 shares. So you'd have a difference, and there's discrepancies. And the whole idea there was to see if the firm was in control of its records and had accurate books and records and information. And in conjunction with that also was the computation in net capital. That was a very big part. It was really financial, operational. You would get the financial statement for whatever period of time you were going in, and you would prepare a trial balance off of their financial documents, off of their general ledger information, prepare a trial balance, and do a computation of net capital under the SEC's net capital rule and see whether they're in compliance or not. And then also, in conjunction with the control exam on the operations side, if there were discrepancies, oftentimes discrepancies led to additional charges for net capital, because if they said they had, you know, 8,000 and they really had 3,000, you got a 5,000 difference, and you got to take that somewhere as a charge. So you would include that. And bottom line was to see whether the firm had controls on the operations side, whether their books and records were accurate, and whether they were in compliance with the net capital, all of which was considered extremely important. It still is, actually.
Did you find a lot of problems at this point?
There were a lot of problems, yes. I mean, there were a lot of problems. That I forget how long of a period we did that, but there were. That was sort of a special program of going and doing control exams for a good period of time.
What was the next step after you identified a firm that was not in compliance?
It depends on how seriously, I mean, as an example, if the computation net capital showed that they had an excess net capital of 100,000, and by going through all of this, in reality, it was only 70,000, I mean, you'd prepare a report because there were discrepancies, and that information would be reviewed for disposition. And I'll tell you about that part of it in a second. But if you found that a firm didn't have adequate net capital in order to stay open, which means they were under what their minimum requirement was, I mean, that was serious. I mean, you violated net capital. The violation is to continue doing a business while you're in violation. And that caused us to ask a firm to require the firm to stop doing the business. So you'd actually, you know, cease doing a business. You'd permit them to liquidate long positions, because liquidating long positions reduces haircut charges on the proprietor. You know what I mean, right? So we let them do that. If customers wanted, you didn't want to lock up customers if they wanted to sell. So if a customer had a long position at the firm and they wanted to sell it, you'd permit that to be done. But nothing that would take on additional liabilities, nothing that would take on additional commitments. It was allowing liquidations along those lines.
Did you get the national office involved at this point?
No.
So this was just something the districts would handle on their own?
New York was a different district.
Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, New York, because of its location, because of the scope of the membership, that was there, and you really had everything there. And because of the size of the staff and frankly the level of experience and expertise of the people on the staff, many, many programs were developed and initiated in New York that ultimately got adopted nationally. The national folks didn't want to accept that, but that's what happened. And when I became national, then I realized that. But, I mean, so this control examination, I mean, this whole thing ultimately became a program that all the districts did.
Okay.
You know, they basically took our procedures, because I'll get into what I was doing there, but, I mean, I was involved in establishing what we did as we got further into the process. But, but the New York district... There, you always had a centralized control, control out of Washington. But in like my earlier times at the NESD, that I didn't really deal with that very much. I was out examining in the beginning, and I'd be bringing these reports back to my supervisor. And then when I became a supervisor, and I don't know whether you want to go through what my career was at the NESD in New York, but
high points.
I mean. It kind of helps. I started out as a trainee, and then there are levels within the examiner ranks. You know, it's trainee, examiner, senior examiner, and, you know, up the line. So I was promoted to examiner, and then I was promoted to a senior examiner, and then I was promoted to supervisor. The examiners all work for a supervisor. They go out and, I mean, the supervisor manages the group, assigns the exams, makes sure it's all being done. The examiners go out and do the work, prepare the report. The supervisor reviews all of the reports that come in, including whatever documentation that's been there, to see whether everything is, if there's problems, whether it's supported by documentation. So when you say what happens after, the exam would come in, it would be reviewed by the supervisor. For most of my career at the NESD, the final adjudication and review and disposition of every examination report was done by the District Business Conduct Committee. The district, did anybody talk to you about district committees?
A little bit, yeah.
The district committees were locally elected officials that came from the members within the district. So, you know, you'd have in New York, you had from New York, New Jersey, whatever, they changed the districting as well, but... And they're locally elected officials, so there's a vote that takes place, and these people are elected. And there was a district committee that dealt with general matters, and the District Business Conduct Committee, when they sat reviewing examination reports and disposition, and when they heard enforcement matters, they served as the District Business Conduct Committee. So the supervisor would review the report and get it ready if it was going to be, and they all got presented, so even the exams that had no action and ones that did have an action. Ones that looked to be areas where there would possibly be formal disciplinary action. I mean, the disposition of an exam could be a file without action, it could be a letter of caution, which is minor, you know, minor violations, but nothing of great substance. At that time, it was called a staff interview, it's now called a compliance interview, where it was a little bit more serious, but not serious enough to fall under the code of procedure for formal. And that would be, you'd have the firms come in and you'd sit down and go over the issues and they'd have to tell you how they're going to fix it. And then the next level would be a formal disciplinary action, which is the most serious action that NESD could take against its members. And that's the filing of charges and, you know, they're entitled to a hearing and there could be fines. They could be expelled, thrown out of business.
How often would that happen?
What?
The formal discipline.
Well, New York had a very an active docket. When I got into a more senior position, I split handling the docket with our counsel. The counsel handled the normal formal disciplinary where the complaints are filed, etc. And then there was an alternate way of settling formal matters, which we actually created in New York. I mean, I don't know if you've heard of the term acceptance, waiver, and consent. Have you ever heard that term? Well, back then it was called admission, waiver, and consent, AWC. And what that was, I mean, we realized, if I'm going into too much detail,
to
shut up. We realized that oftentimes when you file a complaint, the respondent says, look, I know I did this, let's try to So that other stuff takes, you file it, a response. And so we said, we ought to have a document where you can roll it all into one. So an AWC is basically the allegations, any mitigation the respondent wants to say, and an agreed upon fine, settlement, censure, whatever the enforcement action, whatever the sanction would be. And there's supposed to be remedial sanctions and punitive. So we had a document that was all in one. I control that docket. And I remember, I think I had like 100 items, give or take, in as I recall. And there were about the same number, on the legal side. But overall, because when I came to Washington, we were doing... There was probably, on average, over 1,000 formal actions between formal and AWC a year, mm-hmm. give okay. or take, sometimes more.
Out of those, and we're talking about the 1970s in there somewhere, how many of these would have been your small brokerage firms and folks like that versus the big guys?
Well, back in that early 70 period, because while I'm still in New York, mm-hmm. The New York Stock Exchange was, still very active in examining its members, which were also NESD members. We would examine those firms for, basically sales practice issues. New York was mainly focused on financial and operational. Our disciplinary actions, it's hard to come up with an exact number, but a good number of them were against sole NESD members. But, we brought disciplinary action, I remember, against the largest of the large, for whether it was free riding withholding violations or, other violations involving mutual funds, areas where, markups. The New York Stock Exchange, they don't have any jurisdiction. They exert it, but they don't have any jurisdiction over municipal bonds. They don't have jurisdiction over mutual funds. They don't have any jurisdiction over tax shelters. These are all over-the-counter areas. So there were disciplinary actions taken against the larger firms as well. I guess on a percentage basis, there would be more against the mid and smaller firms that were NESD members only. But it really didn't matter.
At what point did you start seeing more involvement from the national level of the NASD?
I would say that was probably around, because I was involved with that, probably around 72, 73. Okay. And I forget, I should know this, but when SIPC came into being, which I think was 71, 72, something like that.
Somewhere in there.
I know for sure it was somewhere in there.
Yeah, that's all we need for now.
But because, SIPC's purpose was to be there to provide funds and securities for customers of firms who were closed up because of financial problems. Not for other sales related, but if they had financial failings, SIPC was there to, and the New York Stock Exchange, always going way back, had a fund that I just remember because Merrill Lynch took over somebody, and I should know, but it was a major firm back then. But part of the New York Stock Exchange funds were used to help facilitate that, and that concept was adopted when SIPC came in, and there was a period of time in there where there were a number, and this is sort of the next big wave of things. There was a number of probably smaller type firms, not mom and pop, but smaller type firms with customer exposure that were running into financial problems. And I forget whether there was, that was the 72, 73, the economy probably wasn't so hot back there, and I remember, 74. So there were a lot of financial and operational problems. And there were a number of SIPC trustee firms. There were a number of the SIPC trustee firms that came out of New York. There was a coordinator in D.C. that was sort of the coordinator between and I'm assuming all the districts, then I'm still, you know, when you're in New York district, you just figure it's me and the world. You right. know, it's New York and the world, which is probably kind of true. But anyway, so, you know, there were reports that had to be made as far as what we were doing on some of these firms and the like.
So you were, NASD is working with CIPIC to liquidate?
Well, CIPIC, no, NASD is the regular. CIPIC doesn't have any regulatory authority as far as examiners or anybody to go out and detect any of this stuff.
Right.
CIPIC is there really as a, and I don't want to use the term insurance because they don't like that, but it's a fund that's there to support in case a firm goes out
right.
of business. And they rely on the self-regulatory organizations in the SEC to enforce the financial and operational rules. And, you know, where there's early warning signs or whatever, to be able to go out and do something to try to prevent these things from occurring.
Right.
CIPIC liquidation sort of was the, not like anything you were proud of. You know,
right.
you would try whatever you can do within reason. I mean, sometimes you just couldn't do anything with them. Sometimes these firms did stupid things that caused them to go out of business. There was a requirement to report to CIPIC so that CIPIC could sort of know what's on the horizon. We used to call them CIPIC Reds and Greens. The Reds put them on, you know, and I mean, how elementary. The memo we sent had red border
okay.
on it, so it went over the CIPIC. And, you know, we had to prepare those. And there was a person in D.C. or a group in D.C. that was supposed to kind of coordinate these. And I don't think that was, at that point, done as well as the organization would have liked.
Okay, but that was NASD staff.
That was NASD staff. So in 73, the gentleman who was the associate director in New York, and that was the second highest position in the district. The first was the director, vice president that I told you earlier, George Bergen. The second in line was the associate director that basically ran the examination and compliance programs in the district. They all the routine exams, and we had a special group that did customer complaints and registered rep terminations for cause. It was the whole special investigations as well as the routine examinations. He was promoted and came to Washington in 1973, and he took over basically that whole area, and it was more than just CIPIC. It was really a stronger voice in Washington to oversee the districts. When he left New York, I was promoted into his job. So in 1973, and in between, I was made assistant director. I mean, there were some other steps in there,
yeah.
but I went from, I became the associate director in like March, I think, of 1973. And then I had responsibility for all the folks in New York. And he came to Washington, and he was in charge of overseeing all the districts.
Is this regulatory he's overseeing?
Yes.
Compliance? Okay.
Yeah. He was, well, you know, don't forget, NASD back then was a regulatory agency. That's all we were. I mean,
right.
at that point, NASDAQ was only like 2 years old. It started, I think, in 71. And it was just a little Bunker Ramo, you know,
yeah.
thing. It was, and so it was to oversee the regulatory programs. And he had people, you know, working under him and that sort of thing. But it was to oversee the financial and operational monitoring, the relations and reporting to CIPIC. It was to oversee the examination program. It was at that point, I believe, as sort of a little turning point because of his involvement in New York. I mean, he was there when we were doing all these things, that a lot of what we were doing got implemented around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And there was more standardization and more similar use of modules that we had developed, and special programs that we had developed were starting to be adopted at all the district offices around the country. And, you know, there were a couple of times a year where there were meetings in D.C. with all of the district management and the management of D.C. I mean, it wasn't like there was never any interplay. There was always a couple of times a year where this took place. I wasn't involved in those in the earlier days because I wasn't high enough up, but in my probably associate days on from 73 on, I was. And, you know, during a lot of these, I used to run some of the workshops to tell other folks what we're doing and how to do it kind of stuff. So it was really to try to educate other people. And that was mainly because, you know, I had worked with, and this is John Wall I'm talking about. John Wall had come down.
Okay. So I'm getting the sense that at this point, early 70s, maybe enforcement wasn't so even all across the country.
I wouldn't say not even. I don't really. I couldn't tell you because.
Yeah, but it was left up to the districts.
It was. There were folks in charge in D.C., but my. And again, I really didn't deal so much. Yeah. I mean, I knew them, but. I think there was more autonomy allowed than happened later on.
Okay.
I mean, I think everybody was sort of left. They all had exams to do. They all had programs. But I think they were more or less left to their own initiative as to how they did it. And they all had district committees, so they all had industry input and what have you. So I wouldn't say it was less. It was just more autonomous and maybe not as uniform.
You've talked about sort of the internals going on. How about externals, like the 75 Acts amendments and things like that, where the overall playing field's changing considerably?
That was, matter of fact, I still have the book inside in the other room. That was a big deal. I mean, I don't remember all the specifics of that. All I know is if I went in and got that book, it's the only one that the binding is starting to come apart on. I probably still have tabs on.
What book is it?
The 75 Act Amendments.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
there's a lot of stuff that happened there. I don't remember
right.
all the stuff.
Right.
All I know is, you know, a lot of times you'd rely on our legal department to do something, but that was something that I personally got very involved in because, I mean, among other reasons, I was in the New York office from 73 to 75, and then in 1975 I was promoted, and I came to Washington. And I was promoted by John Wall, and I came down and basically took over his position because he moved up to another position. In fact, I used to kid him because, I mean, he would move up and I'd move into his. He would move up and I'd move into his. I told him to keep going because this is good stuff. You know? So I came down to Washington in 1975, and I think my title was Director of Enforcement. But in that role now, whereas when I was in New York, I had responsibility for all of the regulatory programs in New York. Now I had responsibility for all of the 14 district offices. I mean, like everything they did, including
right.
the dealing with the committees and stuff like that. And I also probably in 75, we had a small group that we used as our anti-fraud group. And these were folks that we would, that, you know, they weren't involved in the day-to-day examinations or review of financial reports or customer complaints that were in the districts, which they had to do. You know, they had routine assignments to do. These were specialized, really qualified people who, when we ran across something that we thought was a manipulation or a fraud and it was going to take 2 months to investigate and you got to be on site in Cleveland, whatever, these guys would go because they didn't have to worry about, you know, 15 focus financial reports coming in there. So I had responsibility for that group. That was in 75. In 76, I got promoted to Vice President Surveillance. And my job, as I remember, stayed pretty much the same. I just was made an officer at that point.
Name keeps changing, though. You've got, compliance comes in at some point.
All the way through.
Yeah. Okay.
We kept changing. I don't even, I mean, it was Vice President Surveillance. Later on, it was compliance. Then it became regular. I mean, we kept changing. There was a debate. And it wasn't like a real, I mean, sometimes you went from compliance to regulation because one is a little broader than the other.
Yeah.
I think I was Executive Vice President Regulation because regulation is broader than just compliance. And we thought that at that job, since I had more than just compliance, which I'll get to later on, regulation was the better term. So.
Was examinations part of what you were responsible for?
I had responsibility for examinations. Well, if you count my days in New York, clearly for that whole period of time, but from the time I came to Washington in 75 until I retired in September of 1997, throughout that entire period of time, no matter what you called me and no matter what organization, I had responsibility for all of the district offices, all of the examination programs, the special cause examinations throughout that entire period.
Okay.
And depending what period you're in, I had other responsibilities, in some cases many others, but I always had the district offices
okay.
throughout that whole time.
Well, at this point, it's to sort of go back to that question I asked before, at this point when you came into Washington, you must have had the opportunity then to look at this big picture, to look at these 14 districts, and sort of assess how people are performing out there. What did you find as far as strengths and weaknesses?
Well, I think I found what John Wall had found. I mean, that you had maybe varying degrees. How do I say this? Most of the folks that were out there, I think we were extremely happy with. As you got into working closely with them and looking to have them adopt improved ways of doing things, or better ways of doing things, or more comprehensive ways, you may find that some perhaps weren't able to handle that as well as others, both from receptivity as well as just carrying it out. So there were, you know, some personnel issues, not many. But the biggest thing, I think, was that it was adapting a more uniform and consistent way of doing the work across the country, whether you're in Seattle, or whether you're in Cleveland, or whether you're in Kansas City. The NESD's responsibilities are the same in all those areas. The members, you know, they're broker-dealers. They may have different areas of focus and different areas of concentration, but they're broker-dealers. If you're going to examine a broker-dealer that's doing mutual funds or tax shelters in Cleveland, there's no reason that it should be done differently in L.A. You should have procedures that are... So I think there was there was a need to just keep proceeding with ensuring that, first of all, we had something that was uniform and consistent. He's okay. I know. Actually, he's one of the directors. He worked, this fellow that's calling was a director, worked for the NESD about 25 years. I still keep in touch. And importantly, always working to improve and enhance, because one of the departments I had in Washington that was right down the hall from me were the guys that wrote the exam procedures. But constantly trying to refine the exam procedures, and as the years went on, trying to get them to be a little bit more risk-oriented, a little bit more where it's not just a check-the-box kind of an approach, but more or less that there's some creative thinking going on in an examination in order to try to deal with the areas where the firm is making most of its money and therefore most apt to have problems. So that was part of what we found. But there was always a constant... constant effort to revise the procedures, and I mean, conceptually, what we wanted to capture, and somewhere along the way, and I forget the year, we kind of tried to do some training in this area, but you tried to capture the thinking of your most experienced, best investigator when they go out to do an exam, and what they do to try to get that process that they go through somehow into a format where a less experienced person doesn't have to work like 5 years to get there, can kind of use that in trying to do a better exam. Mm-hmm. We had what I would call an examination. It was called an examination module. It had questions and you had to answer yes and no with checks and what's up. And so you had to do that so that you had at least a safety net of a minimum of what was going to be done. You know, you had to have these things when you're going in to do these things. You wanted people, though, that to be able to, if they got an answer on something, without having to say, if you get a yes, and sometimes you had to do that, but you wanted them to be able to have a minimum amount of information, but then kind of think out of the box. And that's where we tried to capture some of this other thinking. But we had very, very, and as the years, if you look at the modules, they really got to be much, much more sophisticated. We, at one point in time, when I started, we had a 5-page exam report. 5 pages was the whole thing. Mm-hmm. A couple of guys that started before me had 2 pages, so we went from 2 to 5. And then we had a much more comprehensive exam. And then we decided that you really can't do that. We developed modules. So you had a municipal module, You had an options module. You had a financial and operations module. I won't go through them all, but you know, so when you went in to do an exam, you know, if you were going in, you were going to focus on certain areas, you took those modules. And then you had a background and interview module, and so you took the modules that you were going to be working on. So you had, and when you do that, you go, if you have five pages and you have three questions on municipals, when you go have a municipal module, you're going to have 55 questions.
Right.
So by its nature, you got very, very much more detailed. But it led to a much more comprehensive examination in each of those areas.
At some point, you you also were taking I know you were working with the New York Stock Exchange sort of on exams, and then later taking over for the regionals. Is that right?
To show you how, going back, how, yes, we worked at the very early stages to come up with a joint examination with the New York Stock Exchange because they were New York Stock Exchange members and they were NESD members. Mm-hmm. And they had, as I said, they focused on financial operational. We looked at non-financial operational, all the over-the-counter. The first, and I can't autograph it for you because I don't have one, but the first joint exam, a gentleman by the name of Joe Kasparak at the New York Stock Exchange, a nice gentleman, and I sat down and we took their, but they had an examination procedure and module, and I had the five-page thing. We went through theirs and ours and said, okay, we'll do this, cut it out, put it here, you do that. And we developed basically what turned out to be a cut and paste of this is going to be your area and this will be our area, so that at least when we went in, we kind of knew the division of labor. And that became sort of the first joint exam module that we did that evolved. So that was back when I was still in the district, so I'll bet you that goes back to 73.
Yeah.
Maybe. And then over the years, I mean, I was still involved in meeting with the New York Stock Exchange probably through the 90s. You know, we'd go up, and what we did was we allowed the New York District Office to coordinate the examinations directly with the New York Stock Exchange since they were in New York. But I would go up, and I would have the exams that we were required to do for that year for all the other districts, and I'd sit down with Sal Palanti and his folks. Sal was EVP and in charge of their exam program, and we would go through and pick out, okay, when you guys, you know, because for the New York, they had to fly somewhere from New York. So when they're doing a Kansas City exam, I got to know when you're going to Kansas City. So they say, look, we're going in June. So we'd look at the June exam. We'd look at the exams that Kansas City District had to do for New York Stock Exchange, try to get a general coordinated program for the year. And we'd go up, I think, in the middle of the year and sort of check it out. But the idea was I'd let our guys know the New York's going to go in, schedule it in June for these firms. They would tell their people before the exam, the examiners would talk so that we'd know exactly when they were going in, and we would meet at the firm and we would do our exams and hopefully cut down on the overlap and duplication at the firm. That was sort of the genesis, and it worked pretty well for, you know, 20-something years.
Yeah.
We also did, you mentioned about the regional exchanges.
Yes.
We entered into what was called 17D2 agreements. 17D2 is a provision under the Securities Act. 17D1 was the designation for financial responsibility of an SRO so that you didn't have everybody looking at the same thing. So in essence, the New York Stock Exchange was the 17D1 designee for New York Stock Exchange firms, financial and operational. And NESD was the DEA for 17D1 for all the rest for financial. 17D2 allowed for an allocation of other examination responsibilities among SROs pursuant to an agreement that had to be filed with the SEC for their okay. So we entered into 17D2 agreements with, I'd say, all the regional exchanges, Philadelphia, Boston, Midwest, Pacific, Cincinnati.
Were they all happy to sort of get rid of this extra task?
They, Generally, yes. As you got through the first, you know, once you have one or two, I don't want to say, I mean, they didn't all have robust exam programs. Let's put it that way. Some were delighted not to have to do this stuff anymore.
Right.
There was a lot of overlap. And what we did was we created, you know, a Midwest Stock Exchange exam module. We created a PhilEx, Philadelphia, you know, because they all have their own rules. We eliminated all of the rules that overlapped because a lot of theirs were like ours. So when we examined ours, we would do theirs. Where there were unique rules that were regulatory in nature on the part of the regions because they had a lot of market-related and that, you know, membership-related stuff. But regulatory rules we incorporated and we would examine for them. Our examiners had training. We had the material so we knew what the rules were. So we would fill out our modules and we would conduct the examinations with their modules and we would provide that over to the regional exchanges. The important thing with that is that all of the regional exchanges at the point in time delegated to us their examination responsibility for members, but they retain the responsibilities to oversee conduct in their respective marketplaces.
Right.
So the PhilEx still had a floor, you know, floor monitoring, et cetera. We did not get into that, but we did examine the joint members. And I think we also examined, I'm pretty sure that we also examined sole members that they gave us authority to go in and examine so that they didn't have to do that either. So that was, yeah, we did that in the 70s. It was in the mid-70s, because I was involved in many of those discussions.
To sort of round out the overview of the broad responsibilities, how much involvement did your people have in sort of proposing new rules and coming up with suggestions on that front?
My people, you mean as far as the scope of the people that I had?
Yeah.
In
your office.
In the 70s?
Enforcement compliance, yeah, as far as...
But we're still in the 70s. Because that'll change as we go forward.
Well,
I have,
tell me when it changed.
Well, I mean, as I took on, when you say my folks, as I moved up the chain, I added departments and responsibilities,
okay,
which gave me a broader responsibility over other areas that involve rulemaking and the like, and
okay,
eventually I had everything, so it was a lot greater in 95 than it was in 78 or 80 or 85.
Okay. Gotcha.
So,
but that capacity was there in the 70s.
The capacity was always there because of, I mean, a number of things. One, I mean, our folks are out doing the examinations, reviewing the, you know, the findings, you know, perhaps seeing areas where either clarifications are necessary or perhaps new rulemaking is necessary. It also involved in, you know, NESD published notices to members. And that goes back to, you know, before my days. But certainly during my days, we issued a lot of notices to members. Notices to members oftentimes came to, one, clarify certain rules. You'll see in a number of our members that, you know, the district offices are noting during examinations that, you know, there are many, many instances where reps are selling away from their firm. They're not advising the firm, etc. There's probably 10 notices that talk about that. So the input that we got from our compliance work, our examination work, our enforcement work, you'll see notices that say that the NESD has issued, you know, 100 formal disciplinary actions over the last year for failing to do this or this, and as a result, members should look at their procedures and make sure they're doing this. So the feedback that we got from the examination program, from customer complaints, from enforcement, led to notices going out to advise members. It led to recommendations for amendments to rules. It led to recommendations for new rules. And in conjunction with that, I mentioned earlier about the locally elected officials in the districts. Each of the district committees would elect a chairman And this is usually somebody that was in, they used to serve 3-year terms. And usually it was somebody that was in their third year, although it wasn't, but it was somebody that had sort of stood out as kind of the leader of the group, and they would be elected by the committees. And twice a year, the chairman of the district committees would come to Washington and meet with the senior NESD staff and the Board of Governors, representatives of the Board of Governors. The overriding purpose of the meeting was for the district chairman to be able to have the opportunity of speaking to the board to discuss issues and matters within their respective districts that were giving them concern, giving them the ability to suggest rulemaking, giving them ideas of maybe enhancing rules, changing rules. But it, what it was industry, senior industry people that were on the district committees speaking to the board. From 75 on, I was the person in Washington that had responsibility for chairing these meetings, for spending a day listening to oftentimes complaints about what was going on, but not necessarily things that had to get to the, maybe things that I needed to deal with, but not things that rose to the level of the board. But I would prepare reports twice a year that would be a summary of these recommendations to the board. And we would present them to the board, and then at the next meeting, I would prepare a report.
We're okay, just checking.
I would prepare a report again to the board describing what steps had been taken in order to address those recommendations. So it wasn't that they just made them and it was like, okay, thanks guys, and it went on. We had to provide updates as to what was happening with these things. And oftentimes the result was that new rules were recommended or new procedures were adopted. But it just gave the opportunity to take somebody from Seattle who's not going to meet with the board to come in, talk to their fellow district chairman to see, we're having that problem too. And you come to a consensus of what's more of a national issue versus something maybe that I got to deal with in one district.
Right.
So that was other input. And then in addition to that, there still are, and I'm not really sure, I haven't looked, but there always was standing committees of the board. I mean, you had the Board of Governors, but then you had a corporate financing committee, you had an investment
right.
company. You know, you're familiar with that.
Yeah.
These folks would meet a couple of times a year, and it was for the purpose of talking about the same thing. What's going on in their respective areas? Where do we need rulemaking? Where do we have a rule that doesn't work and it's not effective or it's not in place? And the whole idea, and those committees would issue reports that would be discussed at the 6 board meetings. The Board of Governors met 6 times a year. The National Business Conduct Committee, which was the board level that reviewed all of the district disciplinary actions. They would all come up to the National Business Conduct Committee for review. Again, they're looking for consistency, uniformity across the country. You didn't want somebody in Seattle being thrown out for 3 Reg T violations and somebody in New York getting, a $400 fine. So
right.
they're looking at it for consistency and that sort of thing. But so all of these matters that would come in from the standing committees of the board that were appointed each year by the board all funnel their way up to the board for deliberation at the board meeting about whether rulemaking was required or whatever action was necessary.
Moving on a little bit, you've been talking a lot about dealing with the broker-dealers, first in New York and then in the national level, the firms. At some point, and you said early on that NASDAQ was just this little thing. Well, by, you're getting into the 80s and it's not a little thing anymore, and you've got a more or less a market to worry about as well. Tell me how that changed the enforcement task and how you dealt with that.
One of the areas that I had responsibility for, I think starting in the 70s, we had a very small market surveillance department. I don't know, it was maybe, if I remember, it was 4 or 5 people. But in the 70s, you really didn't have, it wasn't trade reporting, so they oversaw the market as best they could back in that time, and I had that group. I maintained responsibility for market surveillance. It used to be called market surveillance. The name was changed to market regulation. But I had responsibility for market surveillance from probably the mid-70s-ish up through 1996. Whenever NESD regulation came into being,
right.
I had responsibility for market surveillance throughout that whole transitional period. So as NASDAQ evolved, we had reporting rules, but they were reporting rules where you, and I don't even remember what the rules were, but they weren't transaction information. You were reporting representative prices and that sort of thing. So we had information that the market surveillance folks monitored, but I think it wasn't until 1980, it was either 81 or 83. I should know that, but I think it was 81, where trade reporting was required for the first time in the NASDAQ stock market. And trade reporting was required only for the national market stocks, NMS stocks. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you remember right, you had national market system stocks, NMS stocks, and then you have other NASDAQ stocks. And you had trade reporting for NMS stocks. Eventually, later in the 80s, trade reporting became effective for all of NASDAQ.
So what does that mean? Does that mean you have a better look at what's going on when you've got...
What it meant was, under the trade reporting rule, and I think it was this way from inception, I mean, that's a long way back, but the details of the transaction were required to be reported within 90 seconds of execution. That meant that you had to report a buy of 100 shares of Microsoft at 17 7/8 at such and such a time, and that had to be reported. That information was reported electronically, and we maintained information of that electronically. We therefore gave us far more real-time information for us to be able to utilize in looking at what was happening in the marketplace. You know, we had a stock watch group, which was there. And Jim Canziano, by the way, was... There were actually two... there were three people that ran market surveillance while I was there: Molly Bailey, Chris Franke, and Jim Canziano. Most of the more advanced technology changes came place under Jim Canziano's realm. Molly was on the earlier stages, and Chris Franke was there during the earlier days of the technology. So both of those guys would have. I mean, if you wanted to get into more detail about specifically what and where, those would be people that would... Okay. But all three of those people reported to me in my role, over the years. But as the technology evolved and as the information became more real-time, we had a group that was in stock watch that took care of quote halts. And what...
Quote?
Quotation halts. And back then, I mean, I don't think we had trading halts, we had quotation halts, but we told folks, if we have a quote halt, you're not supposed to be trading during that time. And basically what that was is issuers had a responsibility to call the stock watch area when they were about to release material news. Not after they released it, but prior to, which gave us the opportunity to consider what the news was, make a determination of whether it was material, and then if we felt it was, to halt quotations in the security in anticipation of material news. The analysts who got the calls, I was the officer, the primary officer, who they called for quotation halls. So I was, any place I went anywhere, they always had to know where I was and how I could be reached by phone.
Huh.
And if I couldn't be, who was my backup?
Okay, what was the purpose of the quotation hall?
The quotation hall was in order to put the market on notice that material news was about to be released so that you didn't have serious disruptions in the marketplace because somebody who was particularly astute knew news that somebody else didn't know. And if you had your finger on the news wires, you'd know immediately, whereas someone who didn't wouldn't. And you had just a lot of disruptive conduct. It continues today. I mean, you see trading halls that take place on the exchanges. It's so that you don't have these explosions of somebody being, especially now, which I'm not as familiar with all of the you know, the microsecond trading that goes on today. But I mean, the idea was that you wouldn't have these incredible disruptions in the marketplace where you had uneven distribution of information that caused some investors to be disadvantaged because they weren't sitting at a terminal or they weren't sitting at a newswire.
I mean, did insider trading factor in that?
Sure. Yeah. Sure. I mean, if it could, of course. I mean, especially because that's part of the kinds of investigations we would look at. You'd have, let's say you had material news, or let's say that some, you know, some issuer didn't, and you call up and you say, what's going on? And they say, oh, well, we just put out release, we're being taken over. Well, we might halt quotations at that point so that at least we can get that news out. But
right.
So one of the things you would look at is, okay, well, what kind of trade? I mean, this is easy kind of stuff. I mean, I can't believe people didn't realize this. But we would look and see what kind of trading activity took place before either the news came out or before the stock broke. And I mean, it was pretty easy because we had all the trading information. So you'd look and see who was doing all the trading, and you'd look to see, you know, whether you had readily identifiable names. Oftentimes, the trading activity, you'd find that it was actually taking place by customers over whom the NASD didn't have jurisdiction. So a good number of our insider trading cases were referrals to the SEC because they involved trading by individuals who we didn't have jurisdiction over. But the sum and substance of it was that as the information became more refined and became a broader applicability across broader markets, the enhancements to the automated systems that were in place got greatly more sophisticated, got greatly more expanded over a wider range of issues, and caused our procedures and policies within market surveillance to be much more sophisticated in what we could do in order to monitor what was going on in the marketplace. I mean, as you carry the evolution to today, a good portion of the examinations that we would do out of market surveillance, and I'll get to that, where you sent examiners out with some information. Today, there's so much information that the examiners, in many cases, don't go out. There are reports that are sent to firms, basically with all of the information already there because you got it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're looking for, okay, can you explain any of this? Because otherwise, you know, you've got a problem. That's how a lot of the sweeps are done today.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really do the sweeps. We would probably call them special exams back then. But so as market surveillance evolved, the scope of their reviews got larger. We established in, I'm going to say, the mid-80s, a market surveillance committee, similar to, in concept, to the district committees. The market surveillance committee charter was to look at the reviews that were done by market surveillance and to adjudicate and make a determination about what do we do with these? How do we deal with them? I didn't want it to be a staff decision of what do we do with these things. And they had gotten to the point where we were doing a lot of these, and we said, look, we don't do this in the district. We shouldn't be doing this here. So we established a market surveillance committee. And the first chairman of the market surveillance committee was Carl Scherer. He's with Carl Scherer and Company up in Worcester, Massachusetts. Carl was the chairman for the first couple of years. Carl had been the chairman of the NASD board, I think, in 83, and became the first chairman. He was sort of like Mr. Market Surveillance Committee. He was the first.
So they're making policy, I guess.
They got to do the same thing that we did in the districts. The Market Surveillance Committee would meet. Mainly, initially, the concept was to review the results of our exams, because they did a lot of reviews. They would look at a lot of issues and find no problems, so those were to be filed without action. We had a lot where we found some minor things, so you'd issue letters of caution and the like, and they found things that rose to the level of serious violations, and we needed a body to say, okay, this should be a formal complaint.
Right.
And then we needed a body, as we did with the districts, when the districts had a complaint and it wasn't handled through an AWC, because you had AWCs in market surveillance as well, where there was a hearing necessary, you would have a subcommittee of the District Business Conduct Committee, which were three individuals that sat, listened to both sides, listened to the evidence, would deliberate, and come down to a decision. Market surveillance, we established the same thing. When we issued a complaint, they respond, whatever, but if there was a hearing, we would have three members of the Market Surveillance Committee, because it's more specialized. You don't want to bring in somebody that was a mutual fund expert, because right. you're dealing with trading activity and market activity. And these three individuals with industry experience would listen to the evidence, listen to both sides, look at the documents, and issue decisions. Okay. So we had basically, you know, the 15th District Committee, but it was the Market Surveillance Committee, focused on market surveillance issues.
Because of the governance of the NASD revolved around these committees, that's why you had to have a committee do it.
Because of the governance back then, until there was a change, only a district committee, and now market, because you had to adopt all of the bylaws and all the other stuff that established the Market Surveillance Committee, the same way the bylaws and what have you established the district committees and the district business conduct committees.
Right.
It sets out what they can do and what have you. Now you had the same support to establish the Market Surveillance Committee, but in those days, self-regulation really meant that it was the business conduct function, whether it's at the district level or the market surveillance level, that reviewed these and applied their businessman's judgment in conjunction with input about what the rules and regulations are to make a determination about filing complaints. The staff just couldn't do it. Didn't have the authority to do it. So that it had to come through the committee. Now, we the staff, I mean, and I was involved going back to 1973 through 1996, in differing levels. And when I was in New York, I was preparing this stuff to go into the district committee in New York to make the presentation to say, what do you guys think? But subsequently, I oversaw all of that happening in all of the 14 district offices by all the district people that were charged with the responsibility to do that. And I went around to every single district committee at least once a year, and I attended these meetings, and I would sit in and listen to what was going on and oversaw all of that, in addition to making sort of, you know, at the district committee part of it, the first part of it, I would give a little overview of what's going on and that sort of thing, and they would ask questions. And then the district business committee would sit, and I would listen to what was going on. So back then, that's how it was done. That's how the responsibility was charged. It was in the hands of the District Business Conduct Committee.
Yeah,
and
it's interesting. Everything worked through the district committee. So when you got NASDAQ and you had to regulate NASDAQ, you essentially sort of treated it like another district.
I guess if there were no NASDAQ, I'm not sure how much a pink sheet market would have led to the establishment of a market surveillance committee.
Right.
But I mean, I think the evolution and the growth of the market, I mean, you think about it, it's pretty, like, remarkable. When I was in the training class in 1969, I'm not going to bore you with this, but, I mean, John Hodges, who was the guy that was a senior vice president, came in and gave us a slide presentation of this new thing called NASDAQ that they were developing. And it was NASD, automated quotations. That's what NASDAQ is.
Right.
And he was giving us this little slide showing the little Bunker Ramo terminal and what it was going to be. So in 71, it came on board. I mean, no one ever envisioned, I don't think even Gordon envisioned how, I mean, conceptually, it was smart. I mean, you have all these market makers all over the country. And now you were going to, for the first time, connect all of them electronically so that you didn't have, and this is not a commercial, but you didn't have to go to the floor of the exchange to find all the people willing to trade these stocks. You had this terminal where everybody that was involved would have some way to input. That evolved. In the beginning, you had representative bids and asks. You really didn't even have a real quote. But eventually, you got real quotes. And you got on a level two, you showed every market maker that was quoting. So whether you were in, you know, Boise, Idaho, or New York City, when you punched up on your bunker on your terminal level two, you saw Merrill Lynch, you saw, you know, you saw Dean Witter, but you also saw Janie Montgomery in Philadelphia. You saw Mesereau in Chicago. You saw all these firms competing on a screen to get business.
Right.
So it wasn't like, okay, you go to Merrill, because you looked and you saw the best market and you went there. So that grew,
right,
and we grew with it. And so, yeah, I think because of the growth and popularity of the market, it mandated more robust regulation, more robust systems, and that mandated that you have a mechanism to sort of regulate that market through the district committees and through the Market Surveillance Committee.
You mentioned pink sheets. And
yeah.
I know those hung on for a while.
Yes.
You also had the over-the-counter bulletin
board. OTC bulletin board, yeah.
Yeah. What was the idea behind that?
The Penny Stock Reform Act, and I forget when that was. I should know that. 1990, maybe?
Yeah, early. It was 1990. Yes.
It was 90, right?
Yeah.
It's scary that I even remember that. But, you know, when you're talking about stages of stuff, you had the market in, you know, the NASDAQ in the 80s, but you then had penny stock issues. That was the late 80s.
Right.
It was a big deal. Penny stock was a big deal. I remember being on a panel in Denver with David Reuter, who was then the chairman of the SEC. And we were in Denver. I mean, talk about being in the home of penny stock. And this was at the annual conference that the director out there of the SEC regional office, Bob Davenport, would hold of the state and federal regulators. And I would go out and speak at that thing every year. But David and I are on a panel, and they were talking about, you know, I remember the question was, what do you think is going to be the big issue going forward? And my mind was penny stocks. And David said, you know, and I remember this was 88, because he basically said, we're declaring, not in so many words, we're declaring a war on penny stocks, penny stock fraud. And we're gonna be working with the NASD, and we're going to be doing this stuff. And going forward from there, I mean, we put together task forces, we put together strike forces. I remember going out there early one morning. We had like 40-some-odd examiners from the states, the SEC, maybe more, NASD, I mean, in a room. We gave them the old go get them, and we gave them firms to go do, and we kept track of it. It was like a battle station, but we went out en masse looking at firms for purposes of net capital, purposes of operations, and purposes of fraud. So penny stock fraud became a very big regulatory, compliance, financial, and operational issue in the late 80s. And we worked very, very closely and very, very well with the SEC in dealing with that. The Penny Stock Reform Act, I'm sure, came out as a result of all of that. And it called for the establishment of some bulletin, of some centralized thing. It just so happened that we at NASD, if my chronology remembers correctly, had already established an OTC bulletin board, whereby we would gather information into this bulletin board of, and I don't think it was quotes, geez, I don't remember exactly, but it gathered information about what was going on. It didn't replace the pink sheets, because they still continued, but it became the more viable entity for, the more recognized entities for broker-dealers to input quotations, and I think that was the genesis. There's a Form 211. I can't believe I remember some of this stuff. Form 211 that firms had to file when they wanted to have additional stocks put on the bulletin board that went through our, originally it was in the anti-fraud department, moved over to the market surveillance department. They had to provide a lot of information about what the company was, where are you getting these quotes from. You couldn't just come in and say, I want to quote Pinto Aeronautics at 7. You had to give some information before we give it the approval. In fact, Ken Worm still does that for market surveillance, market regulation at the NASD today.
Okay.
What is he doing it for? He's probably doing it for pink sheet stocks.
Right. So at this point, market surveillance has got to be pretty big.
Market surveillance grew pretty significantly, absolutely. I mean, I think there are over 200 people now.
Yeah.
But, and that's, you know, you can verify that with Tom Gira, who runs it now. Tom Gira is the EVP that runs Market Rank for FINRA right now. But it grew dramatically. Yeah, I mean, to show you, I was on the sixth floor at the NESD, probably through the whole, well, we're all over the place, but on the sixth floor. I had my group, I had financial responsibility, which were the guys that look at financial, you know, they provided the financial and operational support to all the district offices. The compliance department that wrote the modules. I had some folks that did some other stuff. And in the back of our floor was the market surveillance department. So it fit on my floor. And, you know, we used to do demos back there and all that stuff, but they were all back there. And then it grew to the point where, you know, they couldn't fit on there anymore. And eventually, market surveillance moved to the Rockville site and took up, I don't know, floor, whatever. And they grew there as well because we picked up additional responsibilities. You know, you've got more information, so now you could look at trade reporting. You got a group that focuses on trade reporting. We got information, now you have to disclose when you're having a short sale, so now we got a group that's looking at short sales, and that's all they do is look at short sales. And another group now that, you know, that focuses on on potential fraudulent and that type of activity. So it grew because as information developed, as systems developed to take care of that, as people's expertise grew, your ability to oversee the market grew, so the department grew. And it got to be a pretty big department. So it did grow.
Newspapers say that around early 1990s or so, they're saying that, you know, NASD is toughening up their, new rules, fines are going up, or you're collecting more fines every year. And I wondered if, you know, does that square with what you recall? I wondered if the 87 market break was behind that, penny stocks.
You know, I don't know what you're citing as far as what the papers are saying. And one of the things I find now is that I'm trying to keep up, so I look at what's in the newspaper. I remember when I was at the NESD, I never relied on the newspaper because they were never right.
Yeah.
So I you know, I'm not... But if you think about what we were talking about there, you know, you had NASDAQ evolving with more information and therefore more regulatory capability on the part of market surveillance and more systems to look at things. You had the penny stock fraud era, whereby you had a lot of stuff going on with investigations that will lead to enforcement actions. They don't always happen the next day. You know, you mentioned, how did I skip over that? The 87 code break.
Yeah.
What a thing that was. You know, back in those, I mean, I'll just give you like 2 seconds, but back in those days, you know, our senior management group, okay, was 4 EVPs. Four EVPs, John Pinto, John Wall, Frank Wilson, and Dick Justice. And Gordon Macklin. So we had our, quote, senior management meeting every Monday, and we sat around a round table with five people. That was the senior management group. And we handled everything that happened at the NESD. I mean, that was the senior management. HR stuff, whatever it was, that was our group. Each of the guys around that place had a responsibility. You know, mine was all the stuff I talked to you about, and John Wall was something else. Dick Justice was technology. Frank Wilson was the general counsel. So the Friday when there was 190-something point drop, I was out in Denver at that conference. Maybe not, you know, maybe the year before, but I think it was the year before the one I mentioned that I was out with David Rubo. I went out every year in October. That's when it was held. Joe Hardiman was there. I don't know if he even talked to you about this. And Joe gave the speech on Friday, and he was talking about the 190-something point drop. And I remember him saying, I wouldn't be surprised if Monday we see this turnaround, and whatever it was. But it was a... So anyway, Monday we're at the senior management meeting, and everything is going... I mean, we're listening to all this stuff going on, and it was a scary time because, you know, we meet at maybe 8:30 and all of a sudden you got all the stuff that you're hearing that's going on the squawks and stuff, that this thing is going to hell in a handbasket very quickly. And it was a scary day. I mean, we listened to stuff going on. We had people going out. We had examiners were going out to firms, finding out what's going on, what kind of positions, you know, because you got to look at this stuff, not send me your report at the end of the week. We're looking at, holy shit, what's going on right now? Let's get out and see what's going on. And it was a scary time. We had a lot of stuff going on. I mean, I can't even remember all the things that were done during that time and after it, because you had a lot of settlement and clearance problems at NSCC. You had a lot of DKs. You had a lot of unknown trades. You had price discovery because markets were moving so fast. A lot of that was going on.
Did you start thinking about how this was going to change your agenda? Must have.
Yeah, I mean, you might have been doing that was sort of a... You couldn't drop everything because you had other stuff that was important. Yeah, I mean, because you had to refocus and deal with this because you had to be able to get through all of this. And from a regulatory side, you had your districts, and we tried not to make it like, you know, every time there was something, you jumped and you had them run, but they had to go out on a lot of special things. I mean, we had a lot going on, and I don't remember exactly all the detail, but I can tell you, we had directives going out all the time asking for districts to go out and gather this information, gather that information, bring this back, let us know what's going on. Throughout that whole period, it wasn't only the Monday and Tuesday, because Tuesday, thank God, something happened. You know, probably late morning, which all of a sudden turned a lot of that around, and the market, you know, thank God came back. So you didn't have what we got 2 years ago, where it was like the end of the world. It was the end of the world for a day and a half, and stuff came back. And I know that you got data that showed how quickly. But that didn't end it for us, because you had a lot of difficult problems dealing with these issues at NSCC. National Securities Clearing Corporation, to settle all this stuff.
But as far as not just dealing with the mess and cleaning up the mess, but going ahead and making sure it doesn't happen again. I mean, certainly a lot of it was technology, and your guy who was doing technology certainly had a lot to think about after that. As far as enforcement was concerned, how did 87 change the way you approached enforcement?
Because of the way the responsibilities were separated within NESD, you did have the technology guys that had to deal with technology, speed of the systems, being able to handle volume, that sort of thing. John was in the area of the market side, so John had a lot, John Wall in his area, and I forget what his title was, probably EVP market something, but John had to deal with the issues that related to, you know, you guys aren't answering. That was part of the other stuff that we had to deal with too, but not answering the calls and not answering the phones. I got involved with some of that. I mean, I forgot that. About trying to discern who wasn't answering because they weren't answering and who wasn't answering because you only have so many hands. I mean, a lot of that was shaken out, but John had responsibility on the market side. And Rick was there. Rick was there. No, yeah. Rick came in 91. So it was mainly on John's side of the ledger about dealing with all of that. But I do remember, you know, I do remember some of the meetings that were held that were around in Rick's time. So a lot of that flopped over. Oh, what am I getting it confused with? Because a lot of that was still working in effect in the couple of years that followed. Because a lot of the, you know, like SOES.
Right.
Right?
Right.
SOES, I don't think you would have ever gotten the automatic 1,000-share SOES had it not been... In fact, I'm forgetting chronology, but SOES may have been an outshoot of this. Because this... And it was because of this inability to get an order executed.
Right.
I think the small order execution system, SOES, came up to say, all right, look, because I remember I got involved in some of this, but this came out more out of the market side of it.
Get rid of the telephones.
Have a mechanism where if I've got a small trade for a customer, I don't have to go to get on the phone with Knight Trading and say I want to get 100 shares of Microsoft for my customer. So there were very strict rules that were written for SOs, where the market said, okay, if you have small orders, and we're going to define that as 1,000 shares or less, and it's for a client, we're not going to be here, you know, as the basket for your trading account. So, you know, if Knight Trading wants to take 1,000 shares of its own position in Microsoft, and they're going to call Mayer and Schweitzer and say, you know, buy my position, we're not going to do that. But we will, if you have a customer order, a true customer order, we'll have an automatic execution system where you go in through SOS and it gets done. And you can't break up big orders. You can't come in with a 5,000 share order and give me 5 1,000 share orders, because that's going to be a violation of the SOS rules. And you can't come in with a professional order for your own account, because that's going to be a violation for the SOS rules. So SOS came into being, and obviously that gave us a whole new set of rules to look at. A whole new set of rules, which mainly was out of the market surveillance department, but I think we also had the districts involved with that. Because then you had folks who found a way, they thought, to circumvent that by violating the SOS rules. And were doing proprietary trading, but they would call it customer trading. And they would break up large orders and say that they weren't breaking up large orders. So you had a whole new set of rules to enforce, and you had a whole new set of enforcement actions for those who thought that they could violate the rules by working around them. So that came up, I'm pretty sure that was in that 87 through 91-ish time when that all came into being. But then there was something else that must have happened in the 90-91, and I don't remember. Well, maybe it was later on, because I remember Rick being involved in some of the meetings with the market makers to try to deal with some of the issues, and I'm trying to remember what the events were. But to answer your question, you had all this happening. You had penny stocks, you had SOS rules, you had this whole, you had the OTC bulletin board, and you had trade reporting. You had a much broader spectrum of our ability to see what was going on out there,
right,
in broader areas.
So you're doing a whole lot more. You've got your staff is increasing greatly.
Dropped it greatly. Our staff, that was always a challenge for us.
Really?
It was always a challenge for us. And now market surveillance increased, but it was a challenge for us under the financial regime at the time to get additional people all the time as much as we thought we needed.
Okay.
I mean, we would do these manpower studies and we would say, you know, given this and this, we need X. But we had to operate within a much, much smaller budget than FINRA deals with today.
And this is because the members are essentially paying for this out of dues? Is that?
It was because, well, how do I... I mean, clearly it was a member-funded organization. That's where the dues came from. Now that expanded a little bit because, you know, you got fees. Because back then, NASDAQ was part of NESD. It was in the same corporate entity. So that there were some fees and what have you. You had fines and assessments that, much smaller than they are today, that would be revenue. You had annual membership fees that folks had to pay. You had assessments that members had to pay based on a percentage of their gross revenue. You had registered rep, RR, every year they had to renew their registration. That brought in fees. So all these fees came in, sort of made the pot that you had to deal with. And you had to work within that pot. So you didn't have unlimited funds to spend.
I guess the pot wasn't growing the way that the market or your needs were growing.
You'll talk to any compliance person you'll talk to will tell you that they don't have enough resources. So as a regulatory compliance person, I couldn't honestly tell you that we always got the resources that we thought we needed in order to do the job, but you had to do the job, so you made do with what you had.
Something else that comes up in this period is you get this new thing called an expedited remedial proceeding.
Yeah.
Where'd
you get that?
I just pulled it out of the record somewhere. And tell me a little bit about the reasoning behind that and its reception.
Well, you know, I'm not sure. Well, the expedited remedial, I mean, there were times, one of the frustrations, when these chairmen that I talked about used to come in for these two meetings a year it used to be called the advisory council. And it was called the advisory council, basically, and I still have a folder in here of the guys that used to be on the advisory council for a lot of the period of time I was there. And they're really heavy hitter folks when you look back on them. But the advisory council would always come in and say, you know, we got this firm, we know that First Jersey, I mean, I'll use a firm that's long gone, we know they're doing this, we know they're doing that, but by the time we bring the discipline, by the time we do the investigation, you know, it takes forever. Or we got a firm that's got these financial issues, we know that there's an issue there, and we don't have a mechanism for being able to deal with it on a timely basis. So my recollection is the first leg of the expedited remedial proceeding was for financial and operational matters. And it was for situations where the firm was in such dire financial and operational status that we needed to have a mechanism to immediately be able to deal with it and not have to go through a disciplinary process whereby we said, look, this guy's under capital, but he won't stop, and what are we going to do? So a year later,
right.
So there was this immediacy of doing it. Receptivity, I'm not sure by who. I think our board understood that there was a good reason for it. I think the commission approved the rule.
Right.
There was, as I recall, some safety nets in there to make sure that it wasn't us going wild. We had to go through, there might have even been a committee or some people that we had to go through when it was expedited that had to get approvals before it was done. I think ultimately there were some quote due process things put into there where if a firm was notified that they were going to be subject to this, they had a certain amount of time to respond and react. And I don't think it got used as much as we thought it might get used, but that was the whole genesis behind why that got done.
Yeah.
Later on, it even got expanded to sales practice matters. But there, if I recall right, the safeguards and safety nets got to be even more so, where it almost became unusable because you had to provide a hearing, and yeah, it dragged on, and it well, didn't.
This idea of needing some mechanism to do things more quickly, the fact that you had to go out to the districts and, you know, you didn't have the budget, it all sort of gets to the idea that, and Joe Hardiman talked a little bit about this, sort of the idea that you've still got this old model of the NASD that's very decentralized. And on the other hand, you've got this NASDAQ that's going gangbusters and is the face of the future stock market. Was there a sense that, you know, the two things didn't match? I guess that's what
I don't agree. If that's what Joe said, I don't agree with that at all.
Okay.
I mean, since I was the person, there is no way that the district operation, of course they're located in different parts of the country. That
right.
was one of the advantages that we thought we had as a national organization. I mean, if we had a problem in Seattle, I didn't have to fly somebody 5 hours to get there. I call the guy in Seattle and say, send the guy down the street.
Mm-hmm.
So we had geographically dispersed offices.
Right.
By no means would it have been decentralized at all.
Okay. Well, I'm thinking of decision making rather than enforcement. I'm really thinking of governance here, you know, and the ability to bring all of these different power centers together to make decisions.
That's
maybe a bigger picture than just running enforcement.
Well, I mean, from the operation of how, was he referring to the decentralized, meaning the district offices? Or?
I think so, yeah, and having to get everybody on the same page if you want to do something new or advance the organization.
But see, that, if you were decentralized, you wouldn't be worried about that because they'd be doing whatever they... I mean, that's my interpretation
yeah.
of decentralized.
Right.
That's the way it was in 69, 70, whatever. It
right.
was decentralized.
Right.
People kind of, you know, they all had exam programs, but everyone was different.
Right.
In my era there, if you went out to a district office, we had a binder of educational circulars. Those were designed for the examiners. Everybody had one. I We sent them out. Everybody had the same binder. When we thought there was something that everybody should know, we had binders of district staff memo, which were more policy issue things. Mm-hmm. And mostly when you look in those, my signatures on those were policy-related matters that were a little above examiners checking on bank reconciliations, including dealing with committees that went out that every district had. So everybody was operating under the same sort of things for us.
Right.
Every district had the same examination modules. I mean, I don't know if I still have. I probably have them in the other one. The same exam modules. No, I don't have them. I couldn't take them when I left. That's true. I have my district staff memo. But they all had the same policies and procedures to work under. Now, were they in different parts of the country? Sure. But were they everybody had the same cycle. They all had the same programs to operate. They reported their information centrally to us in Washington. So every month I had a report that showed what every district was doing. I knew where they were on every exam, not every exam, but I knew that, you know, district in New Orleans was ahead of their program because they were starting. I knew where they were on aged matters. I knew where they were on aged customer complaints. I knew where they aged on aged docket items. I had a central control. If I saw something that looked to me like somebody was getting behind, I could find out and send them some help. Okay. So it was anything but decentralized. Now, did the district committees meet where I wasn't involved? Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
But they met on matters that were centrally established in Washington and applied uniformly around the country.
Okay.
And I used to review, I mean, I was a pain in the ass, excuse me. I was a pain in the neck.
We can edit that.
In reviewing what they sent in, I looked at every summary of a complaint that went out, I reviewed, because those summaries were prepared by somebody in my office, because it was captured on CRD.
Okay.
I reviewed every summary of a decision. If I saw something that struck me as odd, I would get a copy of it and review it. I would review district committee minutes, not every single one, but I'd review them.
So the enforcement mechanism worked pretty well in that setup.
Not only enforcement, though. It was the whole compliance program as it related to the district operation.
Okay.
It wasn't just enforcement was just the complaints and decisions. Right. All of the other things that I talked about, customer complaints, that was all the compliance, the examination, all of the other things that they did.
Okay.
Plus, I would not only meet with the district committees at least once a year, but I'd go out and meet with the district staff at least once a year.
Okay.
With my guys, you know, the financial guys and stuff, and we talk about compliance, we talk about the programs that we're doing, right. Get some input and all that thing. So it was centrally administered, carried out, geographically dispersed.
Okay.
But not
the
same.
You didn't see any tension between the two, between Washington and the district.
Well, maybe if you ask them, they might, you know. But I had a very good rapport with the district directors.
Okay.
I think they'll tell you to a person. Now, you know, do they agree with me all the time? Listen, some of the people that I still am closest to as friends that I communicate with are the district directors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just had dinner with one of the fellas 2 weeks ago when I was out in Denver for a hearing, for an arbitration that I was testifying as an expert witness. I mean, I communicate with probably 80% of them.
Okay.
Yeah, well, from the district back to the NASDAQ then, and the odd aides.
So let me just finish. So from that, and from market surveillance side of it, which was the other part of my... of the big enforcement sort of thing, but oversight,
yeah.
That was Rockville.
Right.
I was in constant contact with, whether it was Chris Franke or more as it evolved, Jim Cangiano. I mean, I'm still close to Cangiano, even though he's retired. I was out there a heck of a lot more than I was out, you know, to the district offices. I was much more involved in what they were doing. And I attended their committee meetings as well. And I was able to do more of those because usually they were local.
Right.
So I included when I used to have, and I'm not going to bore you with this, but I want to dispel this decentralized thing.
Sure.
When I had my two meetings a year with my direct reports, I mean, one of them was just the directors.
Right.
And the other one was every supervisor and above would come in. So that was like 200 people coming in for that. The other was 40. But I expanded that. In the beginning, when I used to come to those from the district in New York, it was just the district offices. But then I took over enforcement. I took over market surveillance. I took over corporate financing, which is the department that looked over all of the filings. I took over advertising regulation, which is the department that looks at all of the, you know, the sales litter, et cetera. I had responsibility for the regional attorneys, which were the attorneys in all the districts that wrote the complaints. Mm-hmm. I had financial responsibility. I had the compliance. When I had these meetings, I included the department heads and their senior folks for all of those groups as well. So we'd meet with everybody there. So we talk about district things, we talk about market surveillance things, we talked about advertising things, we talked about corporate financing things, we talked about the legal things. They were all together. I mean, so everybody kind of knew kind of what page everybody was on, so when we're talking about a program, the corporate financing people kind of know what we're talking about.
Right.
Not the detail that these other folks would do. And then I had special meetings. Bill Schief used to be the head of the regional attorneys. Bill reported to me, but Bill then would break off and have a separate meeting with the regional attorneys with an incredibly detailed agenda about what to go over for there.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of communication and there was buy-in. I never got any feel. Now again, you know, if you ask one of
I think Hardiman's perspective as president, you know, was that he was had to deal with on the governance side. He had to deal with the power centers. He wasn't. You were. And what you're saying makes sense. Is that there really was, you know, the NASD really was coming together operationally. And but on the other hand, he was really thinking about, you know, how do I get these
and that was his level of what he was. I mean, I had considerable autonomy. I mean, we had our senior management meetings when Joe became the president and CEO when we would report it. But Joe didn't ask me, you know, the details of where are you at. I mean, you know,
right.
He knew.
Right.
We reported to the board. You know, there were six meetings a year, so there was my information was part of what was reported into the board.
Right.
The NBCC work, the National Business Conduct Committee work, was the culmination of all of my direct reports. It was the districts. It was market surveillance. It was everything where there was a disciplinary action came from something that I had responsibility for. So it all funneled up to the National Business Conduct Committee level, which funneled to the board level. So Joe saw indirectly the culmination of our what I would always viewed as our most serious output,
right,
which is our formal disciplinary actions. So, I mean, he knew from his level, but he had other stuff to do. I mean, he
Absolutely.
Was the president and CEO. He had to work with NASDAQ. He had to work with issuers. He had to work
right.
with the board. I mean, he had
right.
broader responsibilities.
And I think he was thinking more on the board level.
Yeah, but I didn't want it
that's
misstated, because that was far from that.
Well, you mentioned market surveillance, and we're getting into the, you know, big things in the 90s, and I want to touch on the Hot Eights and get a sense of, you know, we know about the professors who wrote the paper. What was the immediate reaction within your market surveillance people? What did you put in place to deal with that in the short term and then the long term?
The paper from the professors, again, but by this time there were more people involved in our, quote, senior management than the little group that I told you
yeah.
about earlier, right? You know, there were others that were, I think John still had responsibility, but there were many others under him that had responsibility to deal with the market.
Right.
Not the regulatory stuff, but the market. There was a division of labor, so many of the issues raised by that report, although NESD was a regulatory agency, really weren't, they were more the market side of it.
Right.
You know, whether somebody's putting in quotes, I mean, some of the folks there had responsibility for trying to narrow quotes. That was in a different division.
Right.
All right? I mean, we kind of knew what it was. We had, on the market surveillance side, there was a rule that was the excess quote rule. And all that was if you had a bid of X, the S couldn't be broader than whatever the couldn't be more than whatever the parameter was of Y. And that was enforced by market surveillance. Frankly, the initial reaction, I'm going to put it in two camps. I don't want to speak for them because Joe was on the other camp. Joe was NASDAQ and worked with those guys.
Right.
But I think it was that the professors misunderstood the workings of the market. It's not me, Sounds, it's just my recollection. That what they were looking at was quotes, but they really should be looking at executions because oftentimes transactions go off, trades go off between the quotes, and that's really more representative of what the market is. And I think the belief was that they were misguided in what they were saying because of what they were looking at. From my side of it, our guys were doing, I mean, they weren't saying that that the market makers are violating any of the rule. We had an excess quote. I'm sure I talked to Kanj in market surveillance about it. Are we seeing any violations of the excess excess quote rule? Excess. I can't remember the exact title of it. Excess quote rule, I think it was. But that had a parameter. I think it was the S couldn't be more than 125%, whatever it was. But it was very confined. So you didn't have much of that because, you know, the quote that was up on the level ones was the inside bid and ask. So even if you had a market maker that was outside the parameters, that quote never got into the inside bid and ask because it was the high bid, low ask, which usually was the quotes of two different market makers. It was only when you got to the level two where you could see somebody whose individual quote might be out of the spread, and that was something that we would follow up on. So the initial was more dealing with the market side of it than the regulatory side. Initial.
Right. But
I foresaw, not that I'm a great foreseer, I remember telling the directors, and I don't want to give away too much stuff here.
That's
because
fine.
This was... But I said, you know, guys, we're a regulatory agency. I said, I have a bad feeling this is going to come back as a regulatory issue, even though at the time it was more of a market side of it than it was a regulatory.
I mean, there must have been some sense of, well, if there is this consistency of only quoting odd eights, I guess that's what it was, or not quoting.
It was quoting evens, no odds.
Only quoting evens. Why didn't we detect this? I mean, that question must have been asked. But inside.
At the time, I mean, we talked about that after it became, you know, I remember the first meeting we had after it, and I think what I expressed to you was sort of the view that was expressed at the first meeting.
Right.
But it... Much of the discussion and much of the discussion was with the market side, with the market makers about that. My side, and I'm not trying to put blinders on, but we all had our responsibilities.
Right.
And so like the trading committee, let's say we had a trading committee. That was... I would attend that once in a while, but I wasn't the liaison. That was on the market side would attend that.
So is there a sense that that's not the kind of thing market surveillance would have been?
That's not the kind
about?
Of thing market surveillance would have been expected to pick up.
Okay.
I mean, people knew what the quotes were, but that was not there was no quote rule violation that was visible by folks putting, because despite what they said, there were people that quoted ace. I mean, come on, there were people that quoted ace.
Right.
There were people that quoted sixteenths. So it wasn't like, oh my God, the spreads were wider. I mean, listen, there's no question about that. I remember that whole concept just dealing from the markup issue. You would look and you'd see spreads, and you know you'd know that there was spreads.
Right.
But market surveillance was charged with enforcing the rule that we had that dealt with quotes, which was the excess bid quote rule. It was designed, the market surveillance is looking for violations of things like insider trading. They're looking for violations of not trade reporting. They're looking for violations of other fraudulent, other market shorts, other market conduct.
Mm-hmm.
But the concept of what the quote was more on the market side of our area,
gotcha,
of the division within the NESD.
How about once the SEC and the Rudman Committee start getting involved. Were you brought in to participate in that process?
The Rudman Committee. I'm forgetting the Rudman Committee was a committee that was self-appointed within the NESD.
Right.
We brought in Rudman to take a look at all the different areas and what have you. I'm sure I got involved in that because Rudman was there for a long time with a lot of people, talking to a lot of people.
Did he come in and talk to you?
I talked to a group of his people. If he was there himself, I honestly think, I don't think he was there a lot. I think it was his firm that was there. And I remember talking to at least three of them. I remember three of their people sitting out in the audience at one of my district directors meetings that I was telling you about, where we talk about what's going on, all taking notes and what have you. So we talked to them, sure. Mm-hmm. And the Rudman Committee wrote a report. The Rudman Committee came out with a report. I don't remember the exact, but the Rudman Committee, made some recommendations that, such as, because before this, you remember I said that the disciplinary committees were always consisting of three members of the committee that were industry people.
Mm-hmm.
They came out with a recommendation that they thought that there should be some staff person that sat on there that was a lawyer that could counsel the firm, counsel the other members of the panel that were going to continue to be industry people, like on what the rules and regulations are. A lot of times the committee would say, what is Article 3, Section 20? What is that? So yeah. There'd be somebody. But they said, however, that person should not have a vote. Mm-hmm. It should be still the industry because this is a self-regulatory organization. It should be the industry. Which made sense. Now, ultimately, the SEC determined otherwise, but that was one of the things that came out of the Rudman Committee. I also think the Rudman Committee came up with a recommendation. There was a number of them. And I do remember that the presentation of the Rudman Committee report was very confidential, and it was made at a Board of Governors meeting, and we didn't get a copy of it until we all got there. And I think I remember one of the recommendations was that the NESD ought to establish a separate corporation called NESD Regulation. And all of the regulatory functions now in the NESD should funnel down to NESD Regulation. I'm pretty sure that that was one of the recommendations came out of the Rudman Committee. Because I remember reading it, and basically, this is not for ego, but I remember the functions were what I was doing. By that time, I had everything that I described to you. Everything of a regulatory compliance and enforcement nature I had. The only thing I didn't have was a membership department. That was a big topic of discussion. A big topic of discussion at the board meeting was NESD regulation. It was where we are with this SEC thing, and that was the whole discussion. And that was probably, I don't know if it was 95. No, it was probably the beginning of 96, if I remember correctly. Because if I remember correctly, Mary Shapiro was there. And it was first announced in December of 1995. I met with the directors in June and December. So I was at the directors' meeting for December. And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal on the morning that I was going down to talk with these folks about Mary being selected as the president of NESD regulation. So I went down, I said, look, Mary, I told them, because the prior Wall Street Journal had two names that were potential, Mary Shapiro and me. And that's what they, I don't know where they got that from, but I guess I was in the job, so they. So I called Mary, because at that time she was the president of the chairman of the CFTC. And I went over and met with Mary in December to kind of just introduce and kind of talk to her about what. And Mary came over to the NESD, I believe, in January of 1996. And NESD regulation didn't get officially approved till sometime in 96, maybe April of 96. But I do remember Mary being at the board meeting where this was discussed. Because there was a period of time there when Mary was there and Joe Hardiman was still there in 96.
Right, he hung on for a little while.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly when, but there was an overlap. And then Mary took over as president of NASD regulation.
Right. And then you stayed with NASD, right,
for a while? When NASD regulation was formed, I was one of the folks that moved over to NASD regulation because that was my job.
And you were doing member firms?
When Mary took over NASD regulation, I mean, this was the first time we had this new entity. It was a brand new entity. And Mary came over and she had with her three people that she had worked with at the SEC. Steve Luparello, who's now vice chair over at the NASD, FINRA now. Elise Walter, who's one of the commissioners with her at the SEC. And Susie Bauman, who came over. And Mary reorganized NASD regulation. She separated out enforcement and had Barry Goldsmith came over as the EVP in charge of enforcement. She separated market surveillance. And Jim Cangiano was still in charge of market surveillance, although Steve Luparello later went over there. And she basically reorganized what had been NASD and separated a number of the functions. And one of the departments that she set up was member regulation. And I became executive vice president of member regulation working under Mary, reporting directly to Mary. And my charge at that point were still the 14 district offices. But I also then picked up the responsibility for the licensing and registration area, which were the folks in Rockville that wrote the series examinations. So that was my area of responsibility under the new NASD regulation structure working for Mary.
How long did you do that?
I was in that position, from 1996 through September 30th of 1997 when I retired at that point. So it was September 30th of 1997.
Okay. Great. You made it all the way through. Is there anything we haven't talked about that we missed?
Not as far as I have to think of the history, but I mean, when I left, I began working in the consulting area with a number of different consulting firms, ultimately now with Renaissance Regulatory Services, which sort of is a successor, not necessarily strictly corporate-wise, but a successor to a number of the other consulting firms that I work for. I started to work for a firm called Dover International that was actually started by two former examiners that had worked for me back in the old NASD days, and that was bought out by BISIS, and that was bought out by Citi, and then Citi rolled it out, and Renaissance was started several years ago by two individuals, Lewis Dempsey and Bart McDonald, both of whom I work with at BISIS, and both of which had worked with the SEC in the Miami office of the SEC, and they're the two folks that I work with now at Renaissance Regulatory Services. And that's where we do broker-dealer consulting and on the compliance and regulatory side, as well as on the investment advisor side.
So you're helping them deal with the SROs?
Everything that we did as a regulator, go in and do, you know, sales practice exams, go in and do supervisory procedures, we do now basically from, I'd call it a preventive compliance side. We'll go in and do some of the same things and say, look, you really need to fix this, or your procedures are deficient here and you got to improve this. And we'll give them a report. I mean, the only thing we don't do that's different is that at the end we don't take any kind of an action. We tell them, look,
right,
you guys got to fix this before. Right. And we do everything. I mean, we do BD startups. We do IA startups. We do independent consulting work. Regulators today, even back in those days when they have an enforcement action, part of the sanction will be that the firm has to hire an independent consultant to come in and review the areas that were found to be deficient and then write a report that gets provided. And we've been named as the independent consultant in a number of FINRA and state matters. We do expert witness work. Anything that relates to what NASD FINRA on the broker-dealer side and SEC on the advisor side from a regulatory and compliance perspective, we do, including registrations and the like, basically from the point of view of preventive, trying to work with firms to help them avoid problems that or enhance ways they're doing things to try to do a better job from a regulatory and compliance perspective.
Makes a lot of sense, actually.
And all of our folks, you know, myself, Lewis, Bart, all of our people at one time or another worked either for the NESD, for FINRA, a state, or the SEC. But we all have regulatory background, which gives us an advantage to be able to go in, because since I was one, I could say this, regulators think differently sometimes. So it's good kind of to know that when you're looking at something, not only how the firm looks at it, but, you know, that's not the way the regulator is going to look at what you're doing. Here's what they're going to see, so you have to do such and such in order to deal with that. So it's worked out really well. I mean, that's 12 years I've been doing that.
Well, I appreciate your taking me through your career as a regulator and thinking differently. Appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you for your time.